Thank you for downloading this podcast of The World at One from BBC Radio 4. The World at One, this is Mark Mardell with 45 minutes of news and comment. The Prime Minister has had his say on the row about the Queen, the tabloid and Brexit.
Michael Gove has made clear that he has no idea where this story came from either.
He's also saying that those who want to leave think the loss of British jobs is a price worth paying. We'll debate if he's right. We'll ask the energy industry if they back plans to cut bills. Labour MP Dan Jarvis has been setting out his vision for the party. Does it mean he wants to be the next leader? 5 years since the start of the Syrian uprising, Lise Doucette has been back to where it all began to see what people there now want.
They want to live in peace. We want this war to stop. We don't want to die like the animals in the streets.
And what do teenagers make of the referendum on Europe?
As we've gone through the subject, learned more about it, I realise that it does affect us. And as we grow up and come into the world of business, it will directly affect us.
The BBC News is read by Susan Ray.
Both sides in the EU debate are warning of the threat to jobs and the UK economy if they lose the referendum in June. In a speech this afternoon, David Cameron will suggest that Brexit campaigners are treating the potential loss of jobs if the country votes to leave the EU as a price worth paying. On the other side, the Leader of the House, Chris Grayling, has dismissed that claim, saying that EU regulations cost jobs. Here's our assistant political editor, Norman Smith.
Leave campaigners have reacted with fury to Mr Cameron's suggestion they regard job losses as collateral damage, a price worth paying to get out of the EU. One pro-Brexit cabinet minister described Mr Cameron's claims as preposterous, shrill, panicky. And the chairman of Leave.eu, Richard Tice, cited jobs lost in the fishing industry as evidence of the price Mr Cameron was prepared to pay to stay in the EU. Downing Street insisted most of Mr Cameron's speech today would be focused on the positive case for Britain's membership, in particular the advantages of being in the single market. However, his suggestion that the cost of mortgages would go up because of pressure on the pound if Britain leaves will inevitably fuel further accusations that Mr Cameron is scaremongering. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister this morning sought to distance himself from the row over the Queen's reported comments on the EU, insisting his conversations with Her Majesty would always remain private.
The energy regulator Ofgem has welcomed a series of measures aimed at reducing energy bills. A long-awaited report by the Competition and Markets Authority calls for a price cap on prepayment meters, which are used in 4 million homes. Critics say the plans don't go far enough. Here's our personal finance correspondent, Simon Gompertz.
The Competition and Markets Authority is estimating that it can get an 8% reduction in prices paid by customers with prepayment meters by imposing a cap. To the disappointment of some campaigners, it stopped short of capping prices for millions of other customers who have been paying over the odds. Instead, a database will be created of those who have been languishing on high standard rates for more than 3 years without bothering to switch and given to rival energy companies to tout for business by post. The hope is that customers will be prompted to opt for better deals, but success will depend on how many respond, and some will see the hundreds of millions of letters which could soon be landing on doormats as just more junk mail, even though they will be able to opt out.
The European Central Bank has cut interest rates further to minus 0.4% in an attempt to stimulate the eurozone economy. It's also announced it's increasing the amount of money it creates, so-called quantitative easing. Here's our business correspondent, Jonty Bloom.
The ECB has already introduced negative interest rates in the eurozone. If you leave money in a deposit account, the bank doesn't pay you interest. You have to pay the bank for the privilege of leaving your money there. That's designed to encourage people to take money out of their banks and spend it, and to encourage banks, which also have to pay for the money they have on deposit, to lend more of it instead. But these measures do not always work, and in particular commercial banks warn that it is, in effect, an extra tax on them. And to avoid it, they're being encouraged to lend money to riskier ventures, the kind of thing that started the credit crunch in the first place. The ECB has also announced further measures to try to stimulate growth by buying the debt of companies.
Security services are examining secret documents said to reveal the identities of fighters with the Islamic State group. They indicate that the militants have set up a human resources centre and interview potential recruits who are required to fill in a form. More from our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera.
The documents look like application forms to join IS. The questions to be answered range from name, country of origin and blood group through to the identity of any person who recommended a recruit, whether the applicant had undertaken jihad before, and their knowledge of Islamic law. They highlight both the way in which the organisation aspires to be a state, but also their vetting of those who come to join. The documents, which have not been independently verified, appear to be a snapshot from late 2013 and early 2014 and are said to have been stolen by a disillusioned member of the so-called Islamic State group who then passed them on to media organisations. The German government said it had received a copy. British authorities would not confirm reports that they too had a set. Such documents, if authentic, would be a useful tool for security services to trace the connections between jihadists.
Delays in accident and emergency units in England have reached record levels. Figures for January from NHS England show that fewer than 89% of patients were dealt with in 4 hours. The target is 95%. Overall attendances were up by more than 10% compared with the same time last year. Here's our health correspondent, Adam Brimelow.
The NHS in England has appealed time and again for people to consider alternatives to A&E if it's not an emergency. The figures for January compared with the same month last year showed the biggest ever increase in attendances, an additional 175,000 patients. There was also a sharp increase in emergency admissions, and delays in discharging patients were near record levels. These pressures all contributed to patients having to wait in A&E. Performance against the four-hour target in January was the worst since it was introduced in 2004. NHS England says given the record demands on services, it's not surprising hospitals saw a dip in their A&E performance.
The Labour MP David Lammy has been penalised for instigating 35,000 cold calls as part of his failed campaign to be Mayor of London. Labour Party members received a pre-recorded message from Mr Lammy urging them to back his bid in August last year. The Information Commissioner says the calls breached privacy rules and fined Mr Lammy £5,000.
Thanks, Susan. The Prime Minister's speech today was trailed as making the positive case for staying in the European Union. But in the excerpt we've seen so far, he's warning of job losses, mortgages going up and a dented economy. But first, in a series of interviews with local radio, he had to wade through questions about the Queen, Brexit and the tabloid press. According to The Sun's front page this morning, the Queen is furious with the Prime Minister rather than them, even though the Palace has taken the unusual step of reporting the newspaper to the Independent Press Standards Organisation after their front page claiming, on the basis of an alleged conversation 5 years ago, that the Queen supported Brexit. On the Today programme this morning, The Sun's editor, Tony Gallagher, defended their story.
Multiple sources, two sources to be precise, came to us with information about the Queen and her views on the EU, and we would have been derelict in our duty if we didn't put them in the paper. It's as simple as that. The fact that the story is inconvenient for a good number of people is not my fault. We serve our readers, not the elite who might be upset at what we've written.
He refused to talk about the identity of their main source, although others have speculated it might be the Justice Secretary Michael Gove or sources close to him. We've repeatedly asked Mr Gove for any comment, but have had no reply. The Prime Minister, speaking in an interview on BBC Oxford, said the matter was being properly investigated.
These are very serious matters, but as far as I can see, Michael Gove has made clear that he has no idea where this story came from either. So you've got a very clear denial from statement from Buckingham Palace and from the Deputy Prime Minister, an investigation underway by the Press Standards Organisation, and I think we should let them do their work.
In a speech this afternoon, Mr Cameron will claim that those who want to leave the European Union believe the loss of jobs would be a price worth paying. He'll say the shock would mean pressure on the pound and jobs being lost.
I'm in no doubt that we are better off, that we'll have more jobs, more investment, more growth if we stay in the EU. And I would urge people also to listen to other voices. I mean, today, Britain's scientists, including Professor Stephen Hawking and many other eminent scientists, arguing that for British science and research, we get a lot out of the EU, not least at Oxford University, which is one of the things that helps to generate a lot of the growth and businesses in our area.
So does that count as project fear or is it solid fact? Dr. Angus Armstrong is Director of Macroeconomics at the National Institute of Economics and Social Research. He's also a fellow at the independent UK in a Changing Europe programme. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
The Prime Minister says leaving the EU would, not might, would mean the loss of jobs. Is he right?
Well, let me start by saying there's a number of forecasts that have been published over a number of years about the benefits of being part of the European Union. Now, they cover a very wide spectrum, but I'd say on the whole, they point to a slight advantage to the UK being a member, and therefore pulling out, that would equate to a slight disadvantage. If that's true, and the big proviso is if that's correct, then in the short term, that would imply fewer jobs. Can I just say that over the medium term, of course, wages adjust and people eventually go back towards full employment. But in the short term, that would be one of the conclusions from those forecasts.
If those forecasts are right, could you put any sort of figure on it at all?
Well, looking across the main figures that people have published in terms of the benefits of being a member of the European Union, on the whole, they're between about 1% and 3%. That's taking out some of the ones on the extremes, sort of looking at the more consensual forecasts. The big difficult question is, what does that mean in terms of jobs? And if I can just reiterate, that's a short-term impact in terms of the jobs. Over the long term, of course, wages adjust, and presumably people's wages will be lower than they would have been otherwise, but they will get back to employment.
And of course, not everybody says that it would mean that jobs are lost. I think UKIP have offered a different analysis.
Yes, and the hardest question here is to know what would the alternative look like? So if you were to pull out of the EU, what would be the trade agreements? Now, there's a number of agreements you could have. Many of the political parties on either side say they could deregulate, have less regulation and so on, which would improve prospects. So it depends on what policies people would put in place after a vote for Brexit. And, you know, there's many scenarios that people have painted. But just the simple Brexit vote alone, so leaving aside what policies people may or may not be able to do, then that negative effect on the economy is probably a consensual estimate.
What do you, as an independent expert, make of all this desire to speculate and peer into the future?
I think that it's important that people know as much information as possible ahead of making what is an extremely important decision. Of course, economics are only one part of that decision, and people have many other dimensions to it. So I welcome the temptation to look at the evidence, but I would just reiterate the key is knowing what sort of arrangements would the UK have with the European Union and, very importantly, with countries outside the European Union. What sort of arrangements would we have if we vote to leave? That's the crucial question that has to be answered in order to make sense of any of these forecasts.
Dr. Angus Armstrong, thank you very much indeed. I'm joined now by Chuka Amuna, a Labour MP and former Shadow Business Secretary who's part of the Britain Stronger in Europe campaign, and Adam Afray, who's a Conservative MP who supports the Vote Leave campaign. If I could turn first to you, Adam, is the Prime Minister right that you are one of those who thinks lost jobs is a price worth paying?
Of course not. In fact, one of the main drivers for those of us who would like to see Britain kind of safer and stronger and more economically vibrant outside the EU is because we would have more jobs in Britain and be more competitive and be able to set up trade deals with countries with which we don't have them at the moment. So I would say that, you know, if you look at Europe, the European Union, it's a destroyer of jobs. 25% unemployment in places, 50% youth unemployment. So we're kind of shackled at the moment to an institution, an old world institution, which doesn't seem to be handling many issues very well. And I think we'd do them a favour and we'd do ourselves a favour if we were to stand on our own two feet and forge our own trade deals around the world.
You think he's wrong about the argument. Is he wrong to make it, to say that you think it's a price worth paying?
Well, it's a little bit rude, isn't it? But and it's completely untrue, because, in fact, it's exactly the opposite. I mean, I think for those who say that they wish to remain in the EU, they've got to tell us why is it that that jobs are a price worth paying, bureaucracy is a price worth paying, 20 billion is a price worth paying, when clearly the European Union is not dealing with immigration appropriately, has got mass unemployment, had the euro crisis, which is still ongoing, and really it seems to have caused an awful lot of difficulties which we could have helped them to avoid.
Chuka Amuna, do you think that it's below the belt for the Prime Minister to make this sort of argument?
No, I think it's perfectly legitimate to point to the risks which would be involved in us leaving the European Union, in addition to pointing to the gains to come. But just with regard to what Adam just said, He seeks to pin the blame for all of the economic problems in different domestic economies in the European Union.
Speaking of me again.
You've just put the unemployment
Try
not to speak across each other.
It'd be good if Adam actually let me finish the sentence. But, you know, look at our situation here in the UK. Me and Adam, we're both two blokes of African descent, African Caribbean descent. If you look at the unemployment rate amongst black males, young black males in the UK, that is 35%. What, are we going to blame that on the European Union? No, of course there are domestic reasons why you have unemployment. But the bigger issues here are the fact that because we are part of the European Union, we can attract a huge amount of foreign direct investment. Many multinational companies choose to situate their European headquarters in the UK because we are part of the European Union, and our membership of it means that we can trade freely without being subject to tariffs with the 27 other member states.
But it was interesting, wasn't it, that Dr. Angus...
membership are clear. What we do not know and what is a step into the unknown is if we leave. You can assert that we'll be able to do this and that trade deal with other countries, but you do not know.
But it was interesting that Dr. Angus Armstrong said that any such reaction would be short term. Things would get even out over the middle term.
Well, I think, look, in the medium to long term, I think it would be pretty awful for our country to be leaving the European Union on many different levels, not just economic, but I think there are good security grounds for us to stay in. Being part of the European arrest warrant, for example, has enabled us to bring people back to the UK to face justice. For example, one of the people who tried to bomb London in 2005. And I think also being part of the European Union amplifies Britain's voice on the world stage when, you know, we're a great country that punches above its weight of 65 million people, but we're trying to make sure our voice is heard when we're competing with the likes of India, the world's biggest democracy with 1.2 billion people, and China. And I think by working together with other countries who share our values, who share our respect for human rights and have similar challenges, we can do that. Now, this isn't to say that, you know, without the European Union, Britain isn't a great country. It is a great country. But the point is, how do we amplify its greatness?
Adam,
and by being part of this club, we can do that.
Adam, isn't it just a fact that there would be a shock? It would be a political shock, and that would have economic consequences.
Yeah, let me just go back to one thing Chuka said. He says that, you know, we have influence within the EU. I'd simply point out that, you know, this is kind of cloud cuckoo land in a way, because every single time the UK has voted against the measure in the European Council, on 100% of occasions, we've lost.
But that's wrong.
And on 75% of occasions, if with a case lodged with the European Court of Justice, again, we've lost. So, in answer to your point, I would say that it's very easy to come up with statistics, as Professor Armstrong has pointed out, one way or the other, when you're talking about projections. So I'd ask people to listen very carefully to the language which is used. So you're pointing out that, you know, the sun will never shine if we leave the EU, that we'll lose jobs. Of course, there will be a change if we were to leave the EU, but let's not forget that there are massive changes in the pipeline if people vote to remain. They're not voting for a status quo. They're voting for all sorts of changes, including a European president, including lots of changes to the bureaucracy, including changes to the ports, which is supposed to be coming out fairly shortly, which may have an impact on Britain as well. So it's not voting for staying the same. It's voting for all those changes which were in the Lisbon Agreement, which have not yet fully been enacted.
Adam Afray, Chuka Amuna, thank you very much indeed. A lot of us are paying more for our energy bills than we need to, mainly because we can't be bothered to shop around. And according to the Competitions and Markets Authority, it costs an average of £300 to £400 a year. So they intend to jab the 75% of consumers on the standard rate, puncture their inertia by setting up a database for all those in this boat and open it up to all the energy companies who want to offer cheaper alternatives. Competition. But isn't that also opening a Pandora's box full of, if not the ills of the world, at least a great deal of junk mail? Here's Roger Whitcomb, who's been overseeing the authority's investigation.
Of course, there will be safeguards for that, because we don't want people being bombarded with junk mail. We've talked to the Information Commissioner. We're confident that this is a really bold move that will allow suppliers to get to that part of the market that may not even be aware that they can switch.
But the Shadow Energy Secretary, Lisa Nandy, says the power companies are still being let off the hook.
It's not at all clear still why some families are being charged hundreds of pounds more than others for exactly the same product. And essentially, the proposals that the CMA have come up with do nothing to tackle the major problems in the energy market, which are lack of transparency and competition. They put the onus on the customer to switch, and they let energy companies off the hook.
We asked to speak to EDF, Empower, British Gas, SSE, Scottish Power, E.ON, but we were told no one was available. Lawrence Slade is the chief executive of Energy UK, the body which represents those power firms, and can join me now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Those firms and others, of course.
And of course, yes. But what do you make of the report?
Well, I think it's there's a lot there for a start, and obviously it's only come out this morning, so we've got to look at that. But I think it's the focus is on the consumer and getting the right deal for the consumer, and that's got to be a good thing.
And do you think that it is opening this sort of idea that we get lots of junk mail through?
I think you raise a very important part there, and as the CMA said, it's absolutely critical that the safeguards are in place there, because we don't want to go from feast to famine, if you will, here. You know, it's really important that we encourage people to get engaged, but no one wants to get bombarded with offers, so we've got to get that balance right if this is going to work.
How?
Well, I think, you know, that's what we're going to have to sit down with all parties now and over the next few weeks of the consultation period and see if we can get something that's really going to make this work in the interest of consumers.
The CMA's analysis shows that customers could have been paying about $1.7 billion a year more than they would in a competitive market. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think, you know, just last month we saw something in the region of 414,000 households switch supplier. And I think the point that comes out of this is that if you haven't changed supplier, then there are 34 in the market at the moment. Yeah, sure, you could save up to £300. And I think the point is you don't have to wait. You can do this now. And, you know, some people have been saying it's difficult to do. It really can actually just take a few minutes and you can make a saving of that nature.
Do you think it's appropriate for those who've been overpaying in that sense to get some compensation?
Well, I think, you know, it's a case of making sure that for your family you're on the most appropriate tariff. For your household circumstances, you're on the most appropriate tariff. It's like if your mortgage comes to the end of a fixed rate term. We enter the market, we make sure we're on a better term. I think what's important here is we get the message across to people that engaging in this market is easy and there are great deals to have for anyone from a number of different suppliers.
One expert behind the energy probe refused to endorse the findings because he thought they didn't go far enough, and that was the economist Martin Cave. He thinks you need a short-term price cap covering a substantially larger number of customers to reset the market. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think the fear that was expressed when the CMA first proposed the price cap across the board was that it could actually have the opposite effect of actually taking more competition out of the market because of people feeling that because of a price cap they needn't switch. And I think, again, what we need to do is be very clear to people that yes, you can switch, yes, it's easy. And I think what we need to be doing is making sure that we're reaching everybody in the market and making sure that the whole country is engaging with this and making sure therefore that we're getting to the vulnerable people, vulnerable customers, and making sure they understand how they can get the best deal and save money.
Lawrence Slade, thanks very much. Labour should be tough on inequality, tough on the causes of inequality, says the Labour MP Dan Jarvis in a speech this morning. If that formulation sounds a bit familiar in its echo of Tony Blair's tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, then that's doubtless deliberate from a man on a wing of a party which wants to build on that legacy. Mr Jarvis has only been an MP since 2011, but he's already being talked of as someone who might challenge Jeremy Corbyn for the Labour leadership. Our political correspondent Ian Watson watched the speech. Ian.
I did indeed, Mark. And in the past, as you know, the Labour leadership was often accused of parachuting favoured candidates into safe seats. Well, Dan Jarvis has actually parachuted into Helmand Province, so many people in the Labour Party like his ex-army man of action backstory. He is often, though, a bit wary of speaking to the press, making his contributions instead in newspaper columns. But today he did take questions from Westminster journalists. However, he didn't let the cameras in, and even the hosts, the think tank Demos, had a struggle to record the event. So apologies for the quality of the audio, but here he is setting out his credo.
If we do not share the proceeds of growth fairly, then the moral foundations of our economy are called into question. Put very simply, Labour needs to be tough on inequality, but tough on the causes of inequality.
Now, I'm not exactly sure what he meant by that catchphrase. I presume relief of poverty through redistribution, but also giving people the skills and wages to avoid poverty in the first place, what some call pre-distribution. He didn't quite spell it out, though, and despite channeling Tony Blair, some of those listening to his speech felt he was repositioning himself not in the right, but the soft left of the party, because he also criticised New Labour for being too relaxed about the gap between rich and poor. But to the key question for now, I asked him, having ruled this out last May, if he'd now reconsider a leadership bid. Half the Westminster lobby then came in behind that and asked a variation of the same question. This is what he said.
I'm very comfortable with the decision that I took in May of last year. My absolute focus is, as I've said, getting out the vote in May, working to support the party, working to support Alan Johnson to make sure that Britain remains within a reformed European Union in June.
So where does this leave the leadership? Are we expecting any MP to move against Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, it might not be Dan Jarvis, but I think it is increasingly likely. Let me just share a few quotes back from members of the parliamentary party. One of them said, "Labour's facing an existential threat. If Jeremy Corbyn leads us into the 2020 election, we are stuffed." That's actually a slightly censored version of what he said. Another said, "Look, I find a new reason to despair every day." One more, "We either act or the party's dead." Now, what's focusing minds at the moment is that at Labour's annual conference in September, Jeremy Corbyn's supporters could well succeed in ensuring he'd unequivocally stay on any ballot if challenged as leader, and there's also an attempt to make it easier for any left-wing successor to get nominated. But for now, the rules are less clear. It's possible Jeremy Corbyn might have to face the hurdle of getting 35 nominations from fellow MPs, a hurdle he cleared only because about half of them thought he wouldn't win last time round. So it's possible he could be kept off the ballot if a contest is held before Labour's autumn conference. However, for various reasons too tedious to relate at the moment, it's not impossible that he does get on the ballot, and a recent YouGov survey of party members suggests he would win. But what I'm picking up is that even so, frustrated MPs close to former leaders Tony Blair and Gordon Brown increasingly think it is worth a roll of the dice anyway, probably in July, but those close to Jeremy Corbyn say that would be a kamikaze operation.
Ian, we'll be watching. Thanks very much. It's 5 years since the horrific war in Syria started. Hundreds of thousands of people have died and millions have been displaced. What began as peaceful demonstrations calling for greater democratic rights in towns right across Syria led to a tough government crackdown and eventually turned into a full-blown conflict. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, has returned to the town of Dera in southern Syria, where the first of the protests began.
We're pulling now into the governor's office, which is encircled now by concrete barriers, walls, but they're all freshly painted with the Syrian flag and a new big banner of President Assad. Really a defiant statement saying he's still here. Now we're being checked. We're coming to see the governor, our first stop in Dera. There was none of this security when we first came here 5 years ago. Marhaba.
Marhaba.
Here's the governor's coming. It's the same. Mohammed Khalid Hanous. We met here 5 years ago. And you're still here.
We are going to stay here until we finish all the terrorists, until we finish the story.
Listen to the sellers hawking their wares, and what a sight to see in this market. Every stall is bursting with produce. Big fat orange carrots, bales of parsley and spinach, apples, tomatoes, lemons, everything for sale here. You'd think this was a prosperous farming community, but driving into Dera, we saw how so many of the fields lie untended. The farmers fled because of the fighting. And this city, no matter how lively it sounds here, is still a city that's divided. We've now been taken to another edge of Dera, and it starts to feel different here. Fewer people on the roads, more sandbag positions, more police and army. Just beyond here at the end of the road where I'm now standing is the area that's controlled by the rebels. Zara, a teacher, lives inside the rebel area. We couldn't go in.
so we reached her by Skype. Despite all that's been lost, she tells me, this revolution would have started no matter what. The Syrian people are being denied their rights. The international community has to wake up, she says. One person cannot continue to rule the lives of Syrians.
My name is Radwan Alkik. Yeah, I am employee here in Damascus University, Daraa branch. Also, I am a student in second year in English language.
What about you and your family? Do you feel safe here?
My mother left to Jordan last summer. My brother now in Dubai. My cousin in Europe. But all of them wish to come back to Syria. They want, because they love their country. They want to live in peace. We want to this war to stop. We don't want to die like the animals in the streets.
But you remember 5 years ago, they wanted freedom, they wanted democracy.
I wanted to do something, believe me. Now we are not left in freedom. Now, if you have any sick baby, you cannot take him to hospital because you cannot leave from your area. We are in prison. Yeah, nowadays we are in prison.
So now we've just said goodbye to our police escort. We're heading back to Damascus, leaving Daraa, leaving the place where it all began. The place where some Syrians dared to believe that the political change here could be as quick as it was in Egypt and Tunisia, where presidents were toppled. But the dream of the Arab Spring died in Syria. And not just that. 5 years on, those peaceful protests have evolved into the most brutal of wars. So much so that many now fear that Syria itself could be lost.
Lise Doucette from Daraa in southern Syria. The government needs to spend £28 billion building a new rail link from Surrey across the centre of London on to Hertfordshire, Crossrail 2. That's the view of the National Infrastructure Commission, which is recommending the Chancellor should make a start by spending £250 million in the budget on planning the route. Lord Adonis is chair of that commission.
Crossrail 2 is going to be essential in the 2030s because of a big capacity shortage on public transport, particularly north-south, both relieving the Victoria and the Northern lines and serving the major London stations of Waterloo, Victoria, Euston, King's Cross and Pancras. Unless there is a big increase in capacity, which can't be got just from upgrading existing tube lines, it will need a new line, then you'll start to see station closures, unbearable congestion and a big threat to jobs and to growth. London will grind to a halt in the 2030s unless it has significant extra public transport capacity. So the case for Crossrail 2 in the 2030s is very strong.
But Greg Hands, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, told the London Chamber of Commerce that it was quite an expensive project, that doing things to reduce the cost could be important, and added that reducing the cost of the proposal would be very good news. Can that be done?
We make recommendations for phasing the Crossrail 2 scheme, so that could reduce the cost. We also recommend that London taxpayers and businesses should shoulder about half of the cost of Crossrail 2 as well. So this is a partnership between London and central government. And I think that those two measures together, looking at reducing the costs and a partnership funding deal between London and national government, is what will make this affordable.
There was an interesting argument in The Economist magazine recently that too much was being spent on flashy projects, big infrastructure projects, and not enough on the basics of roads and rail and bridges and even traffic lights, they said.
You need both to upgrade infrastructure, which is happening in London in a serious way. Most of the tube lines have been upgraded. The Piccadilly line will be one of the next. But where you've got massive expansion of population and jobs, as you will have in London over the next 15 years, you will also need to look at some completely new infrastructure. Some of this will be smaller scale. We need to look seriously at bridges across the Thames and East London, where a major obstacle to growth and to housing is the inability to get across the Thames. But also a big scheme of the kind of scale of Crossrail 2 is going to be essential to bring about a really significant increase of capacity on the north-south routes, which don't benefit from the Crossrail 1 scheme opening in 2 years' time, which goes east-west.
What about that biggest of infrastructure projects, Heathrow, or at least the expansion of London's air capacity? Are you disappointed that's been delayed?
The government has said it intends to take a decision this year, and I think that's a good thing. We do need a decision on airport capacity, and the Davis Commission made clear recommendations as to what should happen there, and I hope the government takes those seriously.
Is there a good reason for the delay?
They said they needed to do more work on air quality, and air quality is a big issue in London. So once that work is complete, I hope they'll be in a position to take a firm decision.
And what do you think the decision should be?
I think the Davis recommendations are soundly based. There was a three-year process of engagement and analysis which led the Davis Commission to recommend in favour of an additional runway at Heathrow, though they also said it would be plausible to have an additional runway at Gatwick, so left the door open to a Gatwick option, but its main recommendation was for Heathrow. The arguments and the evidence behind those recommendations looks to me to be sound, and I hope the government takes that seriously.
Luda Donis. The European Central Bank has cut its interest rates yet again. They were already below zero, now they've been cut to minus 0.4%. This is, of course, intended to help the struggling European economy grow more, but there are worries, particularly among bankers, that the latest rate cut could push the euro towards a new crisis. Jonty Bloom is our business correspondent. Jonty, tell us more about what they've said.
Well, the ECB was widely expected to cut interest rates, but it's gone much further than that. It has cut that main rate to 0.4%, a minus 0.4%, so basically you have to pay to put your money in a bank. It's also cut two of its other benchmark interest rates. It wasn't expected to do that. It's increased the amount of quantitative easing, so it's going to pump billions more into the European economy. And also, it is going to extend its buying of bonds from buying state bonds to buying companies' bonds. And that's important because it is a way of directly influencing the cost of borrowing of Eurozone business, and therefore much more direct, and that wasn't expected.
And what's the idea?
The idea is to try and raise inflation and stimulate growth, because the Eurozone has basically got a problem with deflation. Inflation is in negative territory, so prices are falling. The ECB has a target of hitting 2% inflation. It has no chance of doing that in the near future. And also, we are not seeing anything like the amount of consumer spending, infrastructure spending, company spending that we need to lift growth in the Eurozone. And this is an attempt to basically charge people if they save money and therefore encourage them to go out and spend it.
Does it look like desperation to you, or just pushing all the buttons they can?
Well, they're pushing nearly all the buttons they can at the moment. The mistake they made in December, when they also increased the stimulus, was they talked about it a lot in advance. So when it arrived, everyone was kind of disappointed. They all kind of went, well, we knew this was coming. So this, no one expected this. It's come as a bit of a shock. It's had a huge immediate effect. So the euro is down, shares are up on the idea that growth will be encouraged and therefore company profits will go up. But will that last in the long term? Will it drag the eurozone back into growth, back into inflation? That's a big question.
Jonty, thanks very much. Hugh van Steenis is the head of European Banks Research at Morgan Stanley. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mark.
Do you think it will work?
Well, I'm in two minds here. I mean, we're worried that making going into negative rates are a dangerous experiment with diminishing positive impact. I mean, I think Jonty put it well. Given the threat of deflation, the ECB wanted to open up the throttle even more than the markets expected. And I think they are pushing all the buttons. But negative rates for me are corrosive to the banking system. The Eurozone relies on banking for 70% of all the lending. And given there's very little loan demand, I think actually this could undermine the profitability of banks and therefore their willingness to lend.
So you're saying it's a dangerous experiment. It could be corrosive. Can you spell out why you think that?
Well, one of the perverse impacts here is that this system can be counterproductive. So in Switzerland and Sweden, where we've had negative rates for longer, the banks have actually put their prices up, not down. So the cost of a mortgage in Switzerland is actually more expensive now since they've gone into negative interest rates. I think secondly, a lot of mortgages on the continent are tracker mortgages. So the good news for consumers is that the cost of borrowing of their mortgages have gone down. But the bad news is the banks then actually start to lose money on the mortgages they've written. And as you undermine the profitability of banks, their ability to make new loans falls. And so I'm concerned that the long-term impact is quite corrosive.
And I've read some concern that banks are being forced into making unsound loans, sort of subprime loans. Is that true?
Well, I think the trouble is that the money is burning a hole in their pockets. And as Jonty mentioned, the new news today was that ECB is now going to pay banks to take money to lend them to society. Now, obviously, if it works, that's great news. But the concern is that they will then take on business which probably they might want to. The other problem, which we've seen in some of these countries, particularly in Switzerland, is banks start to lend outside of their own region because they just can't make enough money. And so I'm worried that there'll be some spillover from this impact for banks starting to lend in America or in Asia rather than the Eurozone. So I think there's definitely some perverse impacts from a policy like this.
Hugh Vancinis, thank you very much indeed. It's BBC School Report Day, a chance for 12 to 16-year-olds up and down the country to investigate issues important to them. The pupils of Dice Academy in Aberdeen have been testing the theory that teenagers north of the border have become more politically aware and engaged since the 2014 Scottish independence referendum. 16-year-olds were given the vote for that big choice, but they won't be able to vote in June's referendum on membership of the EU. This report is from Iona and Aaron, both 14, both pupils at Dice Academy.
Hi, I'm Iona.
And I'm Aaron, and we're both at Dice Academy.
Our teacher for Modern Studies is Miss Lawrence. The referendum is going to be coming up soon, so she thought if we knew more about it, then we would have much more of an understanding of it, so we could get our opinion across.
Other people feel that kids or teenagers don't have an input or importance to those kind of subjects. That's because we don't have a vote.
When I first told them that we're doing the EU, I think there was a bit of reluctance because I thought it was quite a dry subject. But because there's been such a huge amount of media coverage and because of the sort of political ramifications and the economic impact of staying in or leaving, they have become really engaged in the whole process. And I think they've enjoyed it. And they've pretty much led this project. They've done the research for it. They've each been given tasks to look at specific areas. They've led an assembly on it.
What do the political parties say? The Conservatives have a split decision, although David Cameron and the government want to stay. Other Tories, like Boris Johnson, want to leave.
SNP support staying. An outvote could trigger a new referendum. UKIP want out. Lib Dems, Labour and Greens want to stay in.
On June the 23rd, it's the referendum day, and everyone in the UK over the age of 18 will be able to have a say. Thank you for listening.
Today in Modern Studies, we have invited two experts to talk about the EU referendum.
Now, we have with us Malcolm Harvey from Aberdeen University, who's going to speak about the political aspect of the EU referendum, the in and the out. And we have Rachel Elliott, who's from the Chamber of Commerce in Aberdeen, so represents businesses. So she can speak about the business and the economic side of things. It's down to you guys. You've done heaps and heaps of research on this.
If the UK left, would this lead to the downfall of the EU?
You can make a case that the EU would actually be stronger because it would remove the awkward partner. There's kind of more integration. There's more kind of common history on the continent. On the other hand, losing Britain kind of weakens it in terms of the prestige, in terms of having this kind of former global power as part of it.
Are we economically stable enough to leave?
The point I would make is that our business will continue to operate whatever the result of the referendum. You know, they'll continue to recruit, they'll continue to sell goods and products and services to countries in the EU and outside the EU as well, and that will continue whatever the result of the referendum.
You know, the campaign to leave will say, absolutely, we could. In fact, we could do much better if we were on our own. The campaign to remain will probably say, yes, we could do it, but why would we want to? And that's probably what it's going to come down to.
Do you think if it's a Leave vote, David Cameron will have to resign? And if he does, do you think Boris Johnson will be the one to take over? And do you think that was Boris Johnson's main motive for joining the Leave campaign?
Yes, no, and yes.
We also asked some senior pupils how they felt, and it makes me as a 14-year-old look forward to becoming older and being able to vote.
I think people who are 16 and 17 will be a lot more engaged in politics than 16 and 17-year-olds in England because of the independence referendum mainly, because as the turnout showed, a lot of 16 and 17-year-olds became very engaged with politics then.
In Scotland, it's really different because in some referendums or some votes, 16-year-olds can vote, but down in England, they don't get that chance. They have to wait till they're 18 to vote, and I don't think it's right. If it's 16 in Scotland, then it should be 16 in England as well.
What has happened is they've gone from a couple of weeks ago not having much knowledge about the European Union to being knowledgeable about the institution, and some of them are having really strong opinions.
as we've gone through the subject, learned more about it, I realise that it does affect us, and as we grow up and come into the world of business, it will like directly affect us and the effects it will have.
This is a roundup of what we've been doing. I'm Iona.
I'm Aaron from Dice Academy, signing off from BBC School Report.
And that's Iona and Aaron, and it brings us to our closing headlines. Both sides in the EU debate are warning of a threat to the UK economy if they lose the referendum in June. In a speech shortly, David Cameron will suggest that Brexit campaigners consider the potential loss of jobs if the country votes to leave the EU as a price worth paying. On the other side, the Leader of the House, Chris Grayling, has dismissed that claim, insisting EU regulations cost jobs. A report on the energy industry by the Competition Authority has called for a price cap on prepayment meters. The European Central Bank has cut interest rates further to minus 0.4% in an attempt to stimulate the European economy. PM's at 5, this is Mark Mardell, and that's The World at 1:45. You can find more podcasts of documentaries and current affairs at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.